Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Derek Mooney.
I'm Paddy Glacken.
I'm Donal Lunny.
And tonight we'll take you on a journey through time. From sunrise over Mount Leinster to sunset in Kilrush and on up to the Inishowen Peninsula, the northernmost point in Ireland. And from there, we'll travel far beyond the Arctic Circle to the land of the midnight sun, where the wildlife and the locals will witness a simultaneous sunrise and sunset. I'll be joined by some of Ireland's best-loved naturalists, and we want to hear from you too, as we invite you to celebrate the summer solstice. To set the tone for the hours ahead, two of Ireland's greatest traditional musicians, Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny.
Thank you, Derek, and it's really great to be here on this special evening in the year. And myself and Donal have picked a few nice tunes which we hope are appropriate to the atmosphere and to the feeling of the day. Donal, what do you think we should maybe start with?
I think, why not Casa an Tugain?
Casa an Tugain, here we go.
The sun rose over the southeast of Ireland this morning just after 5 a.m. when author, playwright and broadcaster John McKenna was out for his morning stroll.
I'm at the end of a long lane here in South Carlow. It's a real old-fashioned lane. And as I made my way down here about a half an hour ago, the lane was full of whirls of midges and low-flying birds, and there are two pheasants striding across the field in front of me. A month ago, this lane was full of the smell of lilac. This morning, the ditches are woven with Queen Anne lace and daisies and dog roses, and the smell is of woodbine. It's quite a breezy morning, and I'm looking across an open field where the cattle are lying down, which augurs well for the day ahead, towards the Blackstairs Mountains and what should be Mount Leinster, but is in fact just a porridge of grey cloud with the tip of Mount Leinster poking above it. And behind me there's a golden field where the silage was cut in the last 2 days, and beside that there's an overgrown mass path that leads down to a wooden bridge across the River Barrow. And as I'm talking to you now, there are four gateways here where I'm standing: one into a field of corn, two into fields of grass, and one into a sand pit. And a robin has just decided to perch beside me on the gate here. And the sky is orange and purple and grey. And the light of the sun is just creeping over the roofs of some farm buildings and falling onto the roof of the Summers household, very aptly named. And there on Mount Leinster, there's just a break in the cloud for a moment now, home of the last Irish wolf, and the sky is beginning to open itself up to the day ahead. And right beside me here are the ruins of an old stone cottage, just two walls left now and the lintel of a low door. And generations of the same family were born and lived and died in this cottage. And if ever a morning welcomed their ghosts back with the warmth and the light, it's this midsummer morning. And here comes the sun now, just breaking between the rags of clouds and sending its light across the fields, across the sleeping cattle. Midsummer morning.
Absolutely wonderful stuff. Thank you very much indeed to John McKenna up at First Light this morning. Let's now head to the west of Ireland, to County Clare, to Kilrush, and say goodnight to Éineann Lana.
Hello, Derek. It's been a lovely day down here in Kilrush. The sun has been shining, actually, since the rooks woke me this morning, going off to work at sunrise at 5:13 a.m. They go off to work the silage fields that John was referring to earlier. The silage fields down here, they're cut an Ubbo One haircut, if you like, and the rooks are going to get their food from there. So actually today was a most magnificent solstice day. We had clear blue skies all day. Out walking, I noticed that the hedges are in full leaf. Now, John was talking about the smells of Queen Anne lace and of other flowers that he could smell, whereas I can smell down here the lovely musky fragrance of the elder flowers. The elders are all in flower, and the heavy smell of them in the air is wonderful. Now, it's been like that all day, and you know, we had clouds, there was northerly winds. It wasn't the warmest day in the whole world, but there was wonderful light down here in the west. And now, as sunset is approaching, the sky has cleared completely. It's completely blue directly over my head. But as I look to the horizon, it gets paler and whiter. There's a lovely sort of peach-coloured pinkness in the sky. And then down where the sky meets the sea is the great ball of the sun. It's clear to the horizon. Often it isn't, but tonight it's clear to the horizon. And there's the big ball of the sun. Now, sunset, of course, is when the very last vestige of that ball of sun sinks below the sea. And it's on its journey. It takes 2 minutes to go from the beginning to the end, and it's halfway already. The sunset is actually happening on the longest day in Ireland, this day that actually has lasted for 16 hours, 51 minutes and 42 seconds. The swallows are flying all around the field, really low here where I am. And behind me in the town of Kilrush, the swifts are screeching through the town, picking up their insects. And there's not a puff of wind. All that northerly wind has gone. It is absolutely beautiful, really quiet. And now as I just watch and I'm talking to you, the sun has finally gone below the horizon. And I just have more peach-coloured sky, but the sun has gone. The longest day is over. The solstice is finished. And do you know, Derek, that this day was 1 second longer than yesterday? Because it is the longest day of the year.
1 second?
That's what it is, yes. 1 second longer than yesterday. But in actual fact, today was 16 hours, 47 minutes and 1 second. And it was longer than yesterday by a whole second. And what's happening really for the solstice is, it comes from the word sun for sol and sistere, which is the Latin for standing still. And what the people observed for though was that the sun rose higher and higher in the firmament to be more and more vertical over us, because what's happening is, as the earth tilts, the sun on this day is directly over the Tropic of Cancer, which is the 23.5 degrees north. And then it's been approaching this for the last however, and now it stops. It stands still, and tomorrow it'll begin to go back. So the day tomorrow will be shorter than it was today. Not by very long, but it will be shorter, and the sun will start its journey to us as we see on Earth. It will appear to go back to being over the equator in September at the equinox, when day and night are the same length, on the 21st of September. And then it will continue, allegedly, from our perspective on Earth, to be actually shining over the Tropic of Capricorn on the 21st of December, which is our winter solstice. And of course, it'll be lower in the sky as well, hence the reason that it can shine into Newgrange, because the angle is completely different. And then on the 21st of December, it'll stand still again. There'll be a solstice, and it'll start its journey, as the people saw it on Earth, back again to our latitudes. So it's absolutely wonderful. The swifts are going to bed as I speak. The bats are coming out, and the world continues. But it's just such a magnificent day, and it has been such a magnificent day, and such a calm evening here in Kilrush. I think I'll come and live here altogether, Derek.
Let's say hello to Richard Collins. Stay there if you would, Aina. Richard Collins is in Malahide in North County Dublin. Well, the sun set there, Richard, about 20 minutes ago or thereabouts, I think.
Yes, Derek, it did. You don't see it from where I am, because after all, Ireland is in the way. Now, there was long ago in the hill, on the hill beside me, a settlement, an ancient settlement. Now, life began on Earth about 3.5 billion years ago. And it's easy to forget the crucial role the sun played as the driving force behind it. Its powers of photosynthesis ultimately sustain all life today. We are such stuff as light is made of. Now, the Boyne Valley tomb builders and the ancient Egyptians had at least an inkling of this. Their religious ceremonies celebrated the sun at the limits of its trajectory. In midsummer and midwinter, the solstices matter most in temperate regions. While daylight length varies little in the tropics, the sun shines 24 hours a day in the Arctic regions. Mm-hmm. We have the best of both worlds in Ireland, prolonged light in summer without winter darkness overwhelming us completely. The vitality of spring merges into the abundance of summer, and the balmy laid back post-solstice days before autumnal preparations for the approaching trials of winter. With the heat of a high summer and food in abundance, rest and recreation provide a welcome breathing space. Birdsong ceases, territorial boundaries lapse, partnerships dissolve and rivalries are forgotten. The furred and feathered creatures begin their annual molt. A choice emerges for birds, however, whether to stay or brazen it out for the winter, or to take wing for more hospitable climes further south. The Arctic tern can't get enough light. It visits both Arctic and Antarctic, trapping more light than any other creature in the world. At the other extreme, worms, moles, and deep sea dwellers shun light completely.
Niall Hatch, you were at midday at the East Coast Nature Reserve in County Wicklow.
I was. I had a wonderful day there. It was a beautiful, beautiful summer's day. The sun was shining, the lovely light breeze blowing through the reed beds. It was lovely to be there. So I was there at noon today. So Derek, when was noon today?
It was at 12 o'clock.
That's what you'd like
to
think.
Usually is it not?
Well, actually, solar noon today, where I was in Newcastle, County Wicklow, was actually at 1:38 p.m. Because, of course, noon is set where the sun is at the highest of the sky at Greenwich, close to London in England. But here in Ireland, we're much further to the west. So mm-hmm. on the east coast where I was, it actually takes another 38 minutes for the noon to reach us. And so you might think, well, okay, why is it not 12:38? Why is it 1:38 is the solar noon? It's because we change our clocks. We're not on Greenwich Mean Time at the moment. In March, we change the clocks to Irish Summer Time, and we won't go back to Greenwich Mean Time until October. So 1:38 today was solar noon, the highest point where the sun was in the sky today. And of course, for the entire year, it was almost directly overhead. Not quite, but the highest it'll be all year. And it was wonderful to see that, to see the birds and the other wildlife taking advantage of that. All the dragonflies and the butterflies were out sunning themselves, basking in that warmth. They won't get any period of longer sunlight than they would have today. The plants obviously were photosynthesizing. We're seeing all those flowers out. Very soon they'll switch into berries. We're seeing the insects now starting to switch as well. Some of the adults will be dying off and laying eggs and then disappearing. And with the birds, what's happening is hormones are changing. Today is the point where all of a sudden, very gradually, different hormones are triggered. They're going out of breeding mode, going out of the territorial mode and switching into molting mode and then migration mode, as Richard was saying. So I was watching those swallows and the swifts today, just like Aina was, gathering up as many insects as they can, because very soon their hormones will be screaming at them, get out of here, head south, have a second summer. And today's the marks the switch for that. It'll switch over. It happens gradually, but today is the actual peak of that.
And this is when you really begin to notice that the birds aren't singing anymore in the morning.
Yes.
The dawn chorus, despite the fact that I was shouting it out before the news headlines, the dawn chorus is gone. That's why it was on my mind.
Yes, and people will notice that bird song dropping off actually rather rapidly now. It's already been petering out, but the dawn chorus is really a thing of the past now. There will still be birds singing, of course. Some birds like the robin sing all year round. Song thrushes and wrens will still be practicing. But the big territorial defence is coming to an end. Most of the young birds have been reared at the moment. Some species like swallows and house martins will continue to breed because they have as many chicks as they can, wood pigeons as well. But actually for most birds now, the chicks are done, raised. It's time for them to start thinking about their own survival.
Well, let me ask you now, Niall, you raised something interesting there. So if you take some birds that can have one or two broods, maybe even three broods, because if there's enough food and the weather is good, why waste a good summer sort of thing?
Indeed.
And they keep going. Why don't they have to keep defending?
Well,
so if they do it at the beginning of the breeding season, why don't they continue to do it?
Well, they do to a degree, but the thing is, at this stage, their rivals all have territories as well, because if they haven't paired up at this stage with the female, because it's the males who do most of the territorial defence, if they haven't paired up with the female at this stage, they're probably not going to. So those territories are kind of fixed. So I almost get the impression at this time of year that the birds that are singing in the mornings and through the day, they're almost going through the motions. They still have to put in a bit of effort. They still have to keep the female keen and impress her, and they don't want any opportunistic males coming in, maybe stealing a mating. So it is still a serious business, but those territories are fixed now. So from that point of view, that behaviour really is coming to an end. And of course, all that child rearing that they're doing, it takes its wear and tear on their feathers, so they have to replace those feathers in the molt. And that's the very next thing for them. Again, triggered by hormones, controlled by the length of the day. So the solstice is very important for these birds.
It is indeed, isn't it? Mm. Have many had second broods this year, or do you get any reports of that?
Well, it depends on the species. So a bird like a blue tit in a nest box, they only ever have one brood, regardless of the weather. It doesn't matter. They're done and dusted now. Birds like robins and blackbirds very regularly have two. A lot of blackbirds would be just finishing their second brood now. Swallows would have three broods in an exceptional year, even four. It's not unusual to have them nesting right the way into October. So really, it very much depends on the species. So there's no hard and fast rule there.
Okay, you can email Mooney at rte.ie. We do want to hear from you. Or you can text 51551.
Email Mooney at rte.ie. Take a look at our website, rte.ie/Mooney.
Email Mooney at rte.ie, text 51551. We're live with you this evening. We're celebrating the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. And as Aina said, 1 second longer today than yesterday. And now we're going to head north, indeed to Ireland's most northerly location, the Inishowen Peninsula in County Donegal, and say hello to Heidi Doherty, who's programme manager for Explore Inishowen. What are you seeing there, Heidi?
Hi there. I'm high up on a hill.
Hope you haven't fallen off the hill. Hello, Heidi. Are you still there? We've lost Heidi. Well, that's modern technology for you. It happens, Niall. Have you been on the Inishowen Peninsula?
Oh, I have. I haven't been for a while because of COVID, but a beautiful part of the world. And of course, it has a very long day because it's so far north. So they experience more daylight there than anywhere else in the country today. But of course, they also have the darkest winters as well. So it's swings and roundabouts. You win one end, you lose the other.
Are there any eider duck up there?
Oh yes, it's a good spot for eider. Anywhere sort of in a line north from Sligo or then around to County Louth, that's the real sort of stronghold for eider. So you do get them up around the Inishowen Peninsula. You get them particularly in northern County Antrim as well. That's a species that's actually increasing in Ireland, and that's a bird that actually you associate very much with the northerly latitudes. So we're at the very lowest edge, the southernmost edge of their breeding range, but they are expanding further south, perhaps because of climate change or some conditions there. But one of my favourites, I remember that documentary we did about them, they're just magical birds, aren't they?
Yeah, when I tell people that if you want to go and buy an eiderdown quilt, everybody thought they had eiderdown quilts for do-fa-do. They didn't, but an eiderdown quilt can set you back for a double, that'd be a 4'6" bed, which is a 5-foot frame, about €10,000, ladies and gentlemen. If somebody only had the good mind to start harvesting the feathers here, it would be a good idea, but they're not breeding in any great numbers at this stage, are they, in Ireland?
Not to make it commercially viable. Of course,
no,
it's a very
environmentally... Because Donegal and that part of the world is one place they do actually breed.
They do breed there, yes, indeed. To make it economically viable, you'd have to have a big concentration there. And of course, it doesn't harm the eiders to actually harvest it. It's a perfectly sustainable form of revenue for people to do it.
It's a symbiotic relationship, certainly in Iceland, where the farmers keep the predators away from the duck in order so they can get their payback, which is the eider down itself.
Yes, and the amount of money that's worth. I think it's 80% of the world's eider down is sold in Japan, and some of them cost more than cars do, as you said. But also, the amount of eider down that's actually harvested each year would fit into one truck, one articulated lorry. That's all there is in the whole world each year.
Listen, we'll try and get Heidi back a little bit later on, because we would like to talk to Heidi about what's going on up there. I'd say the sun is going to be well set. Oh, she's there again. Heidi, you're back again. Hi, Heidi. No, hello, Heidi. Heidi. No, she's not. Okay, I think we'll take some music. Let's go back to Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny.
Thanks, Derek. That's just brilliant. You can almost taste the sunset from here. It's fantastic. So over to you, Paddy. What would you like to do?
You sure can taste the sunset. And I'm just thinking of a tune that could be kind of go with that sort of feeling, that sort of sense of being in the west coast of Ireland, off the coast of Donegal, Gola Island, Tory Island, or up off the Inishowen Peninsula, indeed. This is a tune called Kilwira.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm.
that wonderful Paddy Glacken and Donal Lunny. I know you love them. You're a big fan, aren't you, Niall?
Oh, I am. How lucky we are to have them. They're world class. And to think that they're doing our little programme. It's brilliant.
I know. We're only paying them a pittance. Anyway, thank you, Donal and Paddy. We'll be back to you again a little bit later on. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. Tonight, you can text 51551 or you can email mooney@rte.ie. We're here until 11:30 p.m. Let's go now to County Cork and say hello to John O'Halloran. Hello, John.
Hiya, Derek. Nice to talk to you this evening.
Where exactly are you?
I'm Derek. I'm in Rochestown in Douglas in Cork, right next to a beautiful stream that's running right down from the woodlands right down into the estuary at Douglas Estuary. It's just a beautiful sight. There's a lovely old bridge there, and occasionally we see dippers along that river.
Well, the last time I was with you in Cork on a river, we were in the company of Pat Smitty and some of your researchers from UCC looking at dippers. You guys have done all of the work, all the research on dippers in Ireland. So tell us more. What are dippers doing at this time of year on this, the longest day of the year? Are they doing anything?
Very little, Derek. Actually, Patrick Smitty and Barry O'Malley and Dario Fernandez Bellon, you might remember, we met and we did some work in Barcelona in a programme previously. And at that time, we were looking at feathers, and that's exactly what the dippers are worried about this evening, because dippers are incredibly quiet now. It's almost senescence. They are very difficult to see. And why is that? Because they are molting. Two kinds of molting is happening in these dippers today and tonight. The adult birds, which we might remember are beautiful, dumpy-shaped black birds with a white little bib, like a little waistcoat. And then the juvenile birds, which were born this year from eggs that were laid in March of this year, they're also on the river, and they started out with a little speckled breast. And they're molting or replacing all of their feathers at this time. And they get really quiet at this time because it's incredibly dangerous to not have feathers. It's not that these birds are naked, incidentally. These birds lose the feathers one by one across their bodies in this process called molting.
John, the whole idea of molting in birds I find absolutely fascinating, because it must require an enormous amount of energy and of protein, because feathers, of course, are made from keratin, the same protein that our hair and our fingernails are made from, and yet they grow so rapidly. It's such an important process for those birds. As you said, they have to replace those feathers so they're not left naked. They do them sequentially. And with dippers, how long does the whole molt usually take?
It takes about 6 weeks, Niall. You're quite right. It is very energetic, expensive. And a few years ago, we did a study, because you might say, how many feathers has a dipper? I'll ask you, Niall. You might know. I don't know if you do.
I don't, I'm afraid.
Okay. So what we did, Niall and Derek and Richard, it was some years ago, we were fortunate. It's very unusual to find a dead dipper. One was killed on the side of the road near Clashmore, County Waterford. And we retrieved the corpse and we removed carefully every single feather. And at that point, we counted 3,400 feathers on a dipper. Now you might say, wow. So what? Actually, what does that difference compare to other species? It's almost double that you find in a blackbird. So at the same time, because we often see blackbirds dead at the side of the road, we also collected three blackbird specimens. And again, in the same process, removed all the feathers. And we found that it had about 1,700 feathers. And what's really interesting is, of course, dippers are aquatic, and that means their feather distribution is quite different from a terrestrial bird. If you ever look at a bird, if you're ever lucky enough to find a bird that's perhaps dead, not so lucky for the bird maybe, but you find that the feathers don't cover the whole body. They're in called what we call terulae. So these are feather tracks on the bird, and there are naked areas called apterulae. In the case of dipper, all those apterulae or naked areas that occur in terrestrial birds are completely feathered, because they need to be waterproofed much more than the terrestrial birds. So a lot of work to replace a lot of feathers and a lot of protein and a lot of insects that they get in the river to meet that need.
Of course, John, the feathers that we see on the surface, the contour feathers, they're only part of the story, aren't they? Because many birds have down insulating feathers and barbules and so on underneath those contour feathers. Did you find on the dippers, do they have more of those insulating feathers or more of the contour feathers or more of both?
Yeah, as you quite rightly say, you've got a whole range of feathers. In fact, there are 8 different types of feathers, and we won't go into all the details here, but they have a lot of down and what we call semi-plume feathers. And essentially And these feathers are interlocking into semi-plumes, and they cover the whole body over and protect them from the water.
John?
Yeah.
I must say the dipper is the most extraordinary of birds in many ways. Among the passerines, its lifestyle is so radically different to anything else, and it depends very much on waterproofing and going down to the bottom and being able to function in places where no other passerine that I know of could possibly survive or live. Now, it does the structure of those feathers, the shape of the body, is that necessary to keep it down? Does it use the current to press it down onto the bottom of the stream? Or does it use energy, the energy of its wings to do that?
In fact, it does. It does both the wings, the body shape, and, as you know, the claws. As Derek referenced the night there, we were out catching birds. One of the great memories of that night was a dipper grabbing Derek's finger, and it was absolutely locking onto it, because they do grab very deeply onto the pebbles or the surface of the river. And you're quite right, Richard. They're very hydrodynamically positioned, so they generally face upstream with the water flowing over the head and down over the body, so it's not pushing back against the feathers. So it's a combination of shape, plumage, and claws that enable these birds, to magnificent birds, if I say, to live in these fast-running streams.
And there's nothing else even remotely resembling it among the passerines in lifestyle. It's truly extraordinary. Now, tell me another curious thing about it. It looks a bit like a giant wren, but its actual relatives, I gather, closest relatives, are actually the thrushes, not the wren. Why on earth does it look so like a giant wren?
I wish I knew that, Richard. That is probably another PhD to do that. But look, I think it's got to do with the hydrodynamics. I mean, clearly these are very expensive to live in or close or on water. So therefore, it typically would be designed in that kind of torpedo shape when it's really facing out, with the beak facing out and then the tail back towards it. I mean, kingfishers, as you know, are also a good passerine bird that can dive and swim underwater. Not to the same extent, as you know, but I think it's the combination of the shape and the size that keeps them to live underwater. Whether related to wrens, probably not. I think it's just the shape that people probably thought they looked like giant wrens. But certainly from the genetic works that we've looked at mitochondrial DNA in dippers and other populations, and we can see they're highly, first of all, the Irish dipper is a unique subspecies, Hibernicus, and then they are, as you say, clustered much closer to the thrushes than they are to any other species.
John, I've always found it interesting that, you know, seemingly such a lucrative way of life in these dippers that these dippers have has evolved so few times in the natural world. There are only four other species of dipper in the world, and no other birds have evolved this kind of lifestyle. Do you think that's down to maybe sheer evolutionary luck, or do you think maybe there are many failed experiments over the years with birds that just didn't work out?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's two possible explanations. The convergent evolution is that you may have a species maybe from a single origin and developing into individual species across the big land masses, as we know, and the number of species that you mentioned. I think there are probably many losses along the way. We know evolution is cruel. Things survive, things don't survive, and I think it just simply evolved into the optimal position for those particular species. But it's a very specialised habitat with a very specialised birds, so perhaps all of the other failures along the way just simply got lost in evolution.
Yeah, survival of the fittest at its finest, absolutely. With the dippers as well, I always just find it fascinating to see how buoyant they are in the water as well, because when they want to come back up, they sort of just bob up to the surface like corks, just float along until they get to a rock or a perch to get out on. And whenever I go looking for them in the Wicklow Mountains near my home, they're always in the roughest water. They're always in the place you think, oh, surely there's no dipper there, and that's where they'll be.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about, of course, and is the eyelashes, an extra what we call a nictitating membrane, which enables them to open their eyes underwater and protect the eye at the same time. And when you're probably looking at them underwater, Niall, I'm sure they look almost indistinguishable from the white flashes of the riffle. And we believe that that's probably an anti-predator mechanism of these birds also. So the flashes of the white, in the same way as the flashes of the bird, are very similar to the ripple water that's running across that you can hear in the background here as it bubbles over the streams in the background.
It's almost inverted camouflage. Normally a camouflage creature stays perfectly still and doesn't move a muscle so that it won't be detected. But the dipper, it seems to me, needs to bob and jump and move, and the eye flashing, the white eye flashing like a drop of water, like a little bit of foam on the surface of the water. So it's kind of mobile camouflage, rather different from anything else that I know of. And the fact that it's in a very fast-moving water seems to be essential, because unless you have the current, the poor old dipper can't function at all. Could it survive in still water to any great extent?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, Richard. A few years ago, I remember writing a proposal saying, why do dippers dip and wagtails wag? And, you know, I think there's a number of possible reasons, some of which you've talked about there, which is an anti-predator device. There may be other reasons why they dip also, which may have got to do with the influence on the prey that are beneath them, but also may have got to also to do with sexual selection. So there are potential mechanisms that are involved there we don't fully understand. But just sticking with the bobbing for a minute, I mean, I think bobbing up and down makes it much more difficult, perhaps in a white river area to actually be seen, and both from above and from below, because if you can imagine the insects that are in the water below, or indeed the insect larvae or the snails or indeed some small fish, they were looking up and they see this white above them. In the same way, if you think of a mackerel swimming in the water today, it's dark above and it's pale below. So that's one possible explanation. And then the predator from above, it also looks dark, so it's indistinguishable from the habitat. But there, we have measured the size of the bib in these birds also, and there, it was certainly with some work that we did with Frank D'Amico in France in the Pyrenees, and we were able to see that the bibs were bigger and better in Irish dippers than they were in Pyrenees dippers. And if that's got to do with sexual selection, then maybe the bibs are really attractive. So a big bib as opposed to a small bib might be kind of cool to have.
I just wonder, is there such a competition for the prettiest bird in nature? Because I would give it to the dipper, I have to admit.
Yeah, I think I would too, Derek. I wish on that one. Because when most of us see it, they look black and white. But of course, when you look closely to them, they have this beautiful band of brown chestnut across the belly. And then for the juvenile birds, bringing us right back to molting, one of the techniques we use as scientists to measure or to understand the ages of birds is by looking at old feathers and new feathers. And even though the juvenile birds of this year that were born this spring and are on the rivers tonight, the juvenile birds don't have a complete molt and they retain some of the flight feathers, and we use that to distinguish between juvenile birds and adult birds right through this summer into the autumn and into early next year. So as a scientist, we use the feathers to understand the ages of the birds, and you might recall previously we also looked at corticosteroids in feathers to look at stress in birds. So it's a really useful, good for the birds, but also incredibly good for research.
And it also tells you about the health of the river as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
John, it was lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Enjoy the rest of your night. Well, it's probably time to go to bed because you've got to go to school in the morning. College.
It's a long night there yet. Lovely to talk to you all again. Thank you.
John O'Halloran, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Derek. Good night.
So we leave John O'Halloran there and we make our first visit to Norway. We're going way up above the Arctic Circle, some 150 kilometres beyond the Arctic Circle. And we're going to say hello now to Marlena Lyko, who together with Kenneth Nyborg founded Polar Adventures. Tonight, they're going to spot the midnight sun on our behalf from their Polar Adventure wild camp in Ramfjord in Andersal. Good night, Marlena. How are you?
Good evening, Derek. I'm doing beautifully. I'm in our polar wilderness camp in Ramfjord in Tromsø, northern Norway, 69 degrees up north.
69 degrees up north. Where are we, Niall? Do you have any idea, please?
We're 53.3 degrees north.
Oh, I see. Well, we're all north anyway.
Yes, we're above the equator. That's
we're
right.
Above the equator. Yes. We're above ground. But, that's, but I imagine it's a very different landscape that you're seeing there to what we're witnessing here in Ireland.
Yes, of course. You know, we are sitting at the mountain's foot in a forest just by the sea. So it's pretty unique with northern Norway that you have the mountains going right down into the sea. And we also have small forests, so we can actually witness porpoise in the water right now. And small fishing boats, small family boats going out to fish. And it's almost daylight here because we have daylight for 24 hours.
I was saying at the beginning of the programme, you're in a country where you can witness sunrise and sunset simultaneously. Will you explain that to our listeners, please?
Yes, so from 21st of May to 21st of July, we actually have sunlight and we have the white nights, as we call them. So it means that the sun, it's pretty much above the mountains all the time. So we have daylight for 24 hours. But then right just before midnight, in the middle of the summer, we can see the sun bouncing down into the water and bouncing back around 12 o'clock. So it takes just a couple of minutes and you can see the sunset and the sunrise at the same time. So it's pretty incredible because that means that you could have a late dinner, or you can have a little date in the middle of the night, or if it's not cloudy and you can see the sky being clear with a strong sunlight, you can have a sun tan in the middle of the night or at 3 o'clock at night.
So the sunset and sunrise is going to happen at 12 midnight your time. Is that correct?
Yes. From 21st of May to 21st July, you can see the sun going gradually higher and higher. And then closer to 21st of July, you can just see the sun just bouncing like a ball into the water and then bouncing back again. And then little by little, it goes gradually darker.
So I think we should come back to you a little bit later on when the sun is setting and rising at the same time. How does that sound, Marlene?
It sounds fantastic.
Okay, look forward to talking to you then. Thank you very much indeed. Talk to you later. Bye.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
It kind of reminds me of the Eurovision Song Contest, talking to Marlene. Yes, here is the results from the Tromso jury. Richard Collins, you've been in Norway. You've been very far, high up in the Arctic in Norway some time ago, looking at birds, were you not?
Yes, I have, and it is a wonderful experience and a most peculiar experience. I was with Niall. The two of us were up there at the Nordkap, at the very northern tip of Norway, and an island. And the terns were as active at 12 o'clock at night as they would be here at 12 o'clock in the day. I wonder about all of this. Do these birds ever sleep up there? I mean, you had eagles wheeling around. You had so much activity in the middle of the night. And the sun is away up in the sky. It's a most wonderful place and a most perplexing place. A most unnatural place for us, because after all, the darkness triggers us to sleep and the dawn light triggers us to wake. But up there, it's bright all the time. But it is truly wonderful.
It was a fantastic trip, wasn't it, Richard? I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I have to say, it takes a while to acclimatise when you're up there when the sun doesn't set, because you don't have those natural cues that it's time to go to bed, that your body doesn't shut down in the same normal way and you end up being completely exhausted. So I think we both crashed after the first day and then you kind of get into the rhythm of it. But it really was amazing. The whole place is just teeming with life there. I always remember we were in a wonderful place called Vardo. It's a very civilised, very luxurious town, really, given the location. But I remember there are only three restaurants in town, and two of them are Thai restaurants. If you don't like Thai food in the Arctic,
how did that happen?
I don't know. It's really, really interesting. But it's a wonderful place, and there were so many seabirds there, the colonies, all the puffins and the guillemots and the Brunix guillemots, and there was a king eider, and I saw 24 white-tailed eagles in the sky, and the sun never set. It was amazing.
Well, you know why they are Thai restaurants? Because there was a fish processing plant there.
Oh, I see.
And Thais came to run it and to work in it. And then when it closed, I gather anyway from the people up there that the Thais turned their hand to restaurants. And that's why you have so many Thai restaurants there.
Well, you learn something new every day. I think we'll have a little bit more music. Let's go back now and join Donal Lunny and Paddy Glacken.
Well, Derek, the next piece of music we have is a tune that kind of has quite a strong Scandinavian influence. It was written by a man called Arthur Darley, who was a fiddle player, an Irish fiddle player. But the tune kind of came into my mind because I was thinking of those nights we spent up in Norway together out on the fjords. And I'm just thinking of those people who were up in Tromso this evening,
yes,
experiencing the sun and all that wonderful change of light. And I just think that this tune is appropriate to that occasion, and we send this tune with all our love to those people up in Tromso.
Ah, lovely.
Here, here.
Lovely. Thank you. Oh, fantastic. You can't help but tap your fingers and tap your toes and tap your bits and pieces. Anyway, thank you very much indeed to Donal Lunny and to Paddy Glacken. And now I think, third time lucky, can we go back to Donegal and say hello to Heidi Doherty, who's programme manager for Explore Inishowen. Hello, Heidi. Have we got you?
You have got me. Yeah, I didn't fall off the sunset, but I was knocked out by the sunset here. It was awesome.
Tell us all about it.
So we have a collection of people up here. Actually, I didn't realise was going to be so many people up here, socially distanced, of course. Mm-hmm. But we all kind of lined up and we just all sat around the ring fort. So it's a dry stone ring fort. So it has an ancient history here. So it adds to the eerie feeling of the mist. And then the sun just slowly went down behind the hill. But the beams of light that are actually almost reflected from the purples and the pinks and the heathers, fantastic.
Oh, it sounds beautiful. But where exactly are you, Heidi?
I'm in the Ringfort in Grenion at Veolia, okay? It's based here at the mouth of the Inishowen Peninsula, and it's 800 feet above sea level. It's probably one of the only ringforts in Ireland that has this predominant place. And it's the seat of the High Kings, some of the mystical people that used to be here in the long Druid years with warriors. They were the horsemen that also were supposed to be, by legend, buried under the earth here, only to once rise again. So this has a very spiritual and mystical kind of feeling to this area. And I think everybody feels it when they're up here.
Well, it sounds lovely. It sounds really calm and clear there. There's not a breath of wind blowing.
No, do you know, when it's kind of crazy up here, the wind can howl straight through your your body. But when it's calm, it's like the most spiritual, peaceful place you could imagine being.
Oh, it sounds gorgeous, doesn't it, Niall?
It does. I really wish I was there. Well, I love being here with you in the studio, Derek.
Thank you very much.
But I can love to be there as well. It sounds lovely. And, of course, experiences the most sunlight in all of Ireland today. Really, really wonderful place. And, of course, that ancient connection is really important because the solstices, both summer and winter, were really important to ancient peoples in Ireland and, indeed, in cultures all over the world. It seems to have been a common thread in many cultures that didn't have any connection with each other. So there definitely does seem to be something very spiritually important there to many people.
Declan Harrison a message in Bruff. He says, just back from the beautiful and spiritual stone circle in Grange Loch Gur with a lovely large sun setting. Sorry, I'm reading it out a little bit late, but I've just got it now. You can text 51551 or you can email mooney@rte.ie. Heidi, thank you very much indeed.
RTE Radio 1.
So let's say hello to Terry Flanagan, who's on a badger watch tonight. Hello, Terry.
Hello, Derek. How are you? I'm in South County Dublin. Yeah. I'm in a woodland and you probably hear the traffic going by me now shortly. It's very near the M50. It's a linear woodland. It's very, very steep. It's south facing and I'm with Gustavo Zolads. Gustavo is Argentinian and he's been monitoring a badger set here for the last while. Now, badgers are easy to identify with those beautiful white stripes that they have and they're widely distributed throughout the country. Now, I'm talking softly because we've had two of them already left the set and we think they're the two females, and in the next couple of minutes we should see the male leaving the set. The two females who left the set, I was here last week, I watched the same thing happening last week. About 10 minutes ago, about 20 to 11 or so, we saw them leaving the set. They come out, they follow a pattern, they're very, very nervous, they're very, very shy, they sniff the air as they come out, they go back into the set again. They're underground animals, of course. They live in these sets and they're nocturnal, so they only come out at night. And we don't know what time they're going to come out at. So we've been here since about 9:15 or so. They come out. What time do they come out at? Well, it's generally governed by the time of sunset, but they'll often emerge when it's still light, particularly at this time of the year, because there's very little night time. There's very little time for them to go foraging. Now, what we saw with the two females when they left, the two of them left, they went back in. in, they left again. Gradually, they moved further and further away from the set, and we haven't seen them since. So we're waiting for the male to emerge. And I know that they forage around here, and they look for food. They stay out for a couple of hours. On nights with ideal conditions, they don't have to be out for too long. They can get all of their food within an hour or so. And the food that they eat, I always thought when I was younger, was led to believe that they feed mostly on earthworms. Well, recently I've been reading that earthworms are not as important for Irish badgers as they are for other badgers in, say, on the continent and Britain. And I know a survey was done recently of the examination of stomach contents of Irish badgers. And during the summer, 22% of their summer diet was made up of frogs, and they also eat the likes of bees and wasps. And we get the greatest variation in summertime in their diet. So they don't depend as much on the earthworms as the foreign badgers do. They have a number of adaptations. They've got small eyes. For an animal that's nocturnal, their eyes are really, really small. Usually nocturnal animals, they have large eyes to collect as much light as possible. But that's no use to the badgers because they spend so much time underground, their eyes would be damaged or irritated from the dirt or the grit, etc. And they also have what's called a tapetum, which is a layer just behind the retina. And this recycles light into the eye. They've got very few cones, so they don't see colour. But, oh, I can see. Hold on a second, Derek. Yes, the male is now coming out. Gustavo, can you see? That's the male coming out now.
Yeah, it looks like the timing couldn't have been better. Yeah, look at him coming. And look at the size of him.
He is really much bigger animal. Look at the eyes. I was just saying there to Derek about the eyes, the way that it reflects that light, that tapetum. And he's also sniffing the air there, but he's a much bigger animal. And he actually looks different, doesn't he, to the two females?
Exactly, yeah, definitely. Like this, the shape of the head looks a bit different, but also, like, I can't get over the size of the male.
And look at the shoulders on him. He's got really big shoulders, hasn't he?
Yeah, and the arms, and like the legs and the arms.
And the claws.
Absolutely. Yeah. The claws, yeah, absolutely.
And I should say for the listeners as well, too, that these badgers can't see us because you have put down an infrared camera on the set. And there's a monitor about 30 metres away from that,
right,
wirelessly hooked up by yourself. And we're about 30 metres further away, and we're round a little corner. So we can't physically see the badger itself. All we can see is him on the monitor.
Absolutely, yeah.
He look such a big, proud animal there?
Yeah, and looks much more relaxed than the two females.
Yeah,
which
the two females, I thought they were very, very nervy.
Yeah, I wonder if that's because they come out first, or it could be that maybe they had young short time ago, but they
he's gone back in again now. Does he go back in often?
He goes in and out.
No, he's coming out again. He's coming out again. Well, see, what we're looking at are the eyes. So when he turns away, we find it difficult to see him.
Right.
It looks like he's looking directly at the camera now. Do you see that?
Yeah, he has detected probably something he's not familiar with, and he's going to pay attention.
And even though it's a night vision camera, we can see the eyes, but we can also make out the body. We can see the stripes. They're very, very distinct.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And even when you get to see them directly live, obviously not in this case, the white is almost that shines in the darkness.
Yeah. He's a beautiful animal, isn't he?
Oh, he's fantastic. He's absolutely
How
gorgeous.
Long have you been studying these here?
We found the set actually with my kids in the October midterm,
right,
and ever since, probably every couple of weeks, I've been here watching them. Now in the summer, like, look at a night like this, like, it's so much more pleasant and so peaceful that I came more often.
But of course, I suppose you've been coming later in the evenings, have you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, usually at the time, more or less at the time that you indicated.
So it was 20 to 11 when those first two came out, and it was about 10 to 11 when that male came out. Are there any more badgers in this set?
In total, the maximum I've recorded are 4.
Right.
Now, regularly, you see 2 or 3. Sometimes not all of them come together at the same time.
Yeah.
And also at some stage, I go home, so they probably come out later.
Yeah. Look, he's looking straight at us now, or should I say straight at the camera?
He's
a magnificent animal, isn't he?
He's absolutely stunning. Like, he's so nice.
He's turning there. He's going away from us. We can see just the back of the animal. We're losing him. He's gone now. So where does he go to now? Does he go with the two females or does he go separate?
It's difficult to follow him once he leaves the set area because they go foraging. They're very low animals, so you can more or less hear them and second guess where they could be.
Yeah.
But, so he might be around, maybe not exactly together, but they can't really go too far. Like, the woodland is not massive. So
no, it's not massive because where we're standing now, there's a railings behind us and there's an estate behind us now. people from the estate can't get into this woodland as such. And as I said, there's about a 50 metre drop down to the main road there, which where the traffic is flying by. But it's a very long woodland. It's probably, what, a couple of hundred metres long. So presumably they stay in here most of the time.
I suspect so. Like, there is no kind of wildlife corridor. You can't really connect, and I would hope they stay here because you can hear the traffic.
Yes.
It could be a bit dangerous for them.
Well, I've travelled on that road there many, many times, and I've never seen a dead badger on it. I wouldn't expect to see one this close to the city centre.
Right. I actually wonder how many people of Dalhousie live around us. They know about this.
Yeah, well, of course, the less people that know about it, the better.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It's just magic to have them.
Are there any badgers in Argentina? I should ask you that, of course.
I actually don't think so.
Yeah.
They have to take that away for you. I'm not exactly sure.
It's wonderful to watch them here, isn't it? He's gone now.
It's magic. It's just magic. Like a place that's so busy and have so many people around it. And then when it gets dark, you know, everything calms down, the noise calms down, and you suddenly see the head popping out. It's just, it's a fairy tale. Like, it's fantastic.
It really is. And will you, or do you normally wait much longer now after they have come out of the set? They're gone foraging, they're looking for food. I haven't seen any young ones yet. They should be out around this time of the year. Have you seen any young?
I haven't in all the time I've been watching them for during this. But I think when they come out of the set, it's not that they're really, really small like fox cubs would be. It's not too easy to tell them apart, probably from a not too big female. Having said that, I've shared the footage I got with the trail cam from the animals, and there seems to be consensus that there is no young in the family.
Okay. Now, sets normally have lots of openings, entrances. Do you know of any other entrance here in this woodland?
I haven't found another entrance
right.
in this woodland. I'm sure there must be. There must be one, but that seems to be the main entrance. And it's, every time I came to see them and I saw them coming in and out, they used that entrance. So maybe it's the only one they have.
So that's the end of it for tonight, is it? We're not going to see any more activity here.
No, exactly. And it's the right moment just to leave, not to disturb them. They're foraging. Luckily, they haven't detected us.
Yeah.
So we'll take our stuff, go away and let them do their thing.
Okay. So, Derek, you've heard it there from Gustavo. We're going to head off pretty shortly now because they will be foraging here in the woodland. Well, I can't see anything on the camera. They haven't come up near us. We also saw a fox here tonight. And I know the last night I was here, there was a row, believe it or not, between one of the badgers and one fox. And there was a metal fence, this metal fence or gating or railings that are here between myself and the estate. And the fox was on one side and the badger was on the other side. And they seemed to frighten each other. And the two of them went crazy and running off on each other. And it was incredible to see it. And as I said, there was a fox here earlier on as well. But as far as the badgers go, the badgers have gone now. They're foraging somewhere in the woodland. We're going to pack up and we're going to head off because we don't want to disturb them anymore. But it's been magical here too on Midsummer's Night as well.
Terry and Gustavo, thank you very much indeed. It was lovely to actually sit back and just listen to the guys out there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And it just shows you that even in an area that's quite built up, we could hear the traffic on the M50 there. There are badgers around. There's wildlife thriving.
Well, a long time ago, we made a pilot program for a program called Mooney Walk, and we filmed badgers up in that area where they are. We're not giving away the exact location for obvious reasons. And a gentleman contacted the program to say that he had badgers which were coming into his kitchen every evening and feeding from his hand. And we said, badgers coming in, feed with, can't be true. And of course, we went up with the cameras and sure enough, there were the badgers sniffing the food out, and then they come in. I don't know what their eyesight, how good it is or how bad it is, but they come in.
It's very poor.
Very poor, yeah. There's a lot of sniffing going on, and they'd come up and then eventually they'd take the food out of his hand. It was quite extraordinary to see it. And I did see it. I witnessed it with my own eyes. Anyway, you can email Mooney at rte.ie or text 51551. We're here until 11:30 p.m. live this evening. Let's get an update on sport now with Michael Corcoran. Michael, thank you very much indeed. We're celebrating the summer solstice. I got a little bit of a cramp there. The summer solstice, the longest day of the year, and we're talking to naturalists who are out and about keeping a keen eye on nature. We'll be talking to Eric Dempsey, who's in the Wicklow Mountains, and he's observing some barn owls. We'll talk to Eric shortly, and we'll be going back up to Norway for that sunset and sunrise. But last week, you might remember, pianist Finian Collins was on the programme on Sunday, and I was telling him what we were doing this evening, and he's decided that he would record a little piece of music for us. And I said, oh, that'd be wonderful. I said, will you release it? Yes, I will. I said, okay, do it. Oh, isn't that just wonderful? That was so appropriate. He's right. It was so appropriate. I know, Richard Collins, you're a fan of Bartok. Are you not, Richard?
Yes, I can remember the first time I heard Bart talk, in fact. And I remember a teacher in school who was very sophisticated musically telling me about Bart talk. He said, well, of course, when you go to films, the music you hear in the score is largely derived from Bartok. It is about not the extreme emotions, the great passions of life and the great big dramas of death and so on. It's about the everyday, the ordinary, the subtle little emotions. And I think Bartok was a wonderful collector of folk music. He collected folk music all over Eastern Europe and Russia and elsewhere. And he had this view that our music and the music of nature are coextensive. There shouldn't be a division between them. One flows into the other. And you get a sense of that here, a very profound sense of that here. It evokes, I think, the indifference of nature, if I may say so. The 19th century evocations, musical evocations of nature, are sympathetic. Everything will be fine. God's in his heaven, and all is going to be well in the end. It'll end up positively. But the 20th century view, nature is indifferent. It does its own thing. What happens to us is not its concern, sort of thing. I have that feeling. If you go to a seabird colony, for instance, you'll hear the great sounds of nature, the kittiwakes calling, the roaring of the gannets, the waves breaking in, the wind, the whole thing. And that cacophony can become a form of music for you. Every time I hear the sounds of the seabird calling, a whole flood of emotions comes in. If you hear the sound of a forest with the birds, the insects, or even open areas where corncrakes or crickets or skylarks, each of these has its own atmosphere. It is its own piece of music for us. Anyway, I'm waxing far too eloquently about this.
Well, give yourself a pat on the back. We're going back to Norway now. Hello to Marlene Lyko again. Marlene, hi.
Good evening, Derek. Welcome to the Arctic.
What's happening? Nothing.
What's happening? It's actually very misty. So the sun is hidden behind clouds. It came a big, big layer of clouds. So it's actually covering almost the entire sky.
So you're not seeing the sun dancing in the sky, no?
No. Right now it looks very grey-bluish, so the sun is hidden behind the clouds. But it's very, very light, so it's almost like normal daylight during the day.
And how long is that going to last for?
It's a little bit greyish as it's such a thick layer of clouds covering the entire sky.
It really sounds very, very atmospheric there. I wish I could see it. You know, after that piece of music that we just heard here, that atmosphere has really been set. It's kind of spooky. And I'm just thinking now about the nature and how it differs at the different latitudes. Even with the cloud cover there, it must be really interesting to see that. Do you get many people traveling from Norway and from around the world to witness this? I know obviously COVID must have affected things, but is it popular with tourists?
Yes, of course. If it would be a normal situation without the COVID virus, then of course we would have plenty of travelers. But right now we are in a very isolated area, so it's not so very many tourists have found us during the summer because it's pretty coldish, you might say, during the summertime. And we hope that we will have a lot of travelers this year, that they will find us as we were isolated from the virus, so we were actually, we had our restrictions, so we were keeping out and we were trying to stay in our cottages. But otherwise, we could move around freely as it's a town with only 80,000 inhabitants. So it's pretty small.
And then, of course, in the winter, when the sun doesn't rise above the horizon, it must be quite a different world there. Do you get many people coming to witness that? And what do people come to see?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. It's our peak season. So from the 21st of November to the 21st of January, we live in total twilight. So we are almost like vampires coming out from the darkness the 21st of January when the first slice of sun rises above the horizon. And she rises and then she goes away again. So it's a pretty, pretty amazing experience for us because even if it's cloudy, we can sense the ray of sun just empowering our bodies. And we become so energetic. And day by day from the 21st of January, we see a bigger and bigger slice of the sun rising above the horizon. So it's amazing. And that's actually our peak season from September to 1st of April. And then from 1st of April, it's like a switch just being switched off and everybody escapes the north because it's not the warmest place on earth during summertime.
Well, I've been there in wintertime, and I've been there in wintertime, and I have to say it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been in my life. I went up to go whale watching from Tromso, and unfortunately, because of the weather, the whale watching was cancelled. But I want to ask you something, Marlene, if I can, and it's to do with the Northern Lights. Do they really exist?
Yes, of course they do exist. And sometimes it depends, you know, from day to day, if it's an amazing night, you know, an epic night, a majestic night, or if it's very beautiful, or if it's pretty, because it depends on the cloud layer, and of course, about it also depends on the solar activity. If we have a strong activity from the sun with a clear sky that night, then of course you might see all the beautiful colors. You might see the lights dancing for you, and it can be just as magical as you might see maybe in a documentary, but it's much, much better in real life. And the zombies, they also believe that it also creates a little special sound, and it has been highly researched if it actually exists or if it's just a myth that you can hear the Northern Lights. But it's amazing when it's strong and when it's active, of course, then it's one of the great treasures on earth. But well, sometimes it's a cloud layer covering it, and it's just like a green grayish hue.
Yeah, that's what I experienced every time I went to see it, and I'm not blaming the Norwegians. I've been to Iceland many times in search of the Northern Lights, and I'm always saying to people, do these things exist, or are they a big con to get people? But at any rate, it's a beautiful part of the world where you are, and we wish you all the very best of luck, and thank you for talking to us this evening, even if the cloud got in the way. That's life. I promised the world and its granny that they would have the sunset and the sunrise on radio at the same time, simultaneously. Well, it did happen. It just happened behind the clouds. That's live radio for you. Marlene, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much and take care.
Okay, God bless. Bye. There goes Marlene. She's 157 kilometres above the Arctic Circle in Ramsfjord outside of Tromso in northern Norway. Tromso is the largest city in northern Europe, northern Norway, excuse me. I think 70,000 to 80,000 of a population. A beautiful part of the world, I have to say. It really is very cold in the winter. But, you know, you go there for that. People don't come here for the sun to Ireland. They come to experience the culture and all that, and that's why you go. We want to go to one of your favourite places now, Niall, to Rockabill. And we're going to say hello to one of the wardens on Rockabill, Emma Tierney. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Derek. How are things? I'm very well out here tonight. We've had a lovely evening so far.
Lovely to speak with you. So how many wardens are on Rockabill at the moment?
There are three wardens out here this year. So it's myself and another girl, Alexandra Fink, and then another man, Michal Fitzgerald from County Cork. And so it's just the three of us out here for most of the season.
Well, hello to you, because it's an uninhabited island and it's important internationally for the roseate tern colony that's there. Tell us a little bit about that.
So, yeah, the roseate tern colony out here is one of the most important breeding colonies of roseate terns, not just in Ireland, but in all of Europe. There are thousands and thousands of terns on this island every year, and you can't quite hear it at the moment because I'm inside, but as soon as you step outside the door, you're just hit by the noise of all of these terns. So we have approximately 1,500 roseate terns and common terns, and then we also have Arctic terns, as well as some other seabirds on the island. We also have black-legged kittiwakes and some breeding black guillemots.
Well, anybody who saw Back from the Brink on RT television several months ago will be familiar, because it was one of the main features we did as the Irish contribution to conservation in Europe. And it's a very important colony now. You witnessed a wonderful sunset there this evening, I believe.
Yes. Oh, the sunset today was just incredible. And I was a bit concerned that we might not get a very nice view this evening because there was a bit of cloud cover. But as soon as the sun dipped under these grey clouds, the whole sky just lit up and it was pink and orange and it was absolutely beautiful. And in my opinion, the best place to to watch the sunset on Rockabill. It's from the West Pier. I know it's called Rockabill Island, but Rockabill is actually made up of two islets. The smaller one is the Bill, and then the larger one that I am on at the moment is called the Rock, hence Rockabill. And so the Rock is where the lighthouse is and the lighthouse keeper's house is, which is where the wardens stay every year. And then we also have the West and the East Pier, just between the Rock and the Bill, and where the boats land, and it's where you landed when you came out to film Back to the Brink last year with us. And this is the best place, like I said, to watch the pier, because not only do you get such a spectacular view of the sun going down over the city landscape and the Dublin Mountains across the Irish Sea, it's also one of the few places where you don't get dive-bombed by common terns continuously, which is a daily occurrence for anyone that comes out here. So it's one of the nicer spots on the island.
Well, continued success with your work. How long will you be there for?
The rest of us, myself and the other two wardens, will be out here until mid-August, maybe about the 13th to the 15th of August is our expected departure date, but it depends on some other factors. It depends on when the birds leave and weather as well. But throughout the season, we also have other people coming out to us. We will have Dr. Stephen Newton, the Seabird Conservation Officer from Birdwatch Ireland, coming out in a couple of weeks' time to start ringing all of the birds. So every bird, every chick that is reared on our on Rockabill Island here gets ringed with an individual BTO number or an individual ring, Rosie Tern ring. And this helps us to identify them whenever, wherever they go, when they go back on their long migration across Africa or when they come back here to us, to Ireland. And some of them might head off to Ladies Island Lake, or some might go to Dublin Port, or they might go over to Skerries or Croquet Island. And those little rings will help us identify them throughout their lifespan.
Well, Emma, thank you very much indeed. That's Emma Tiernan, and to her colleagues who are wardens on the island there, looking after those birds during the breeding season. Very important work it is too. So you can see, even on the longest day of the year, naturalists and conservationists are out working. We're going to speak to another one now, Eric Dempsey, who's in the Wicklow Mountains, and Eric has been observing and logging barn owls all day. Where exactly are you, Eric, or can you tell us?
I am afraid I can't tell you, Derek. I'm in a place where I'm not allowed to say where I am. All it is I am in County Wicklow, and I have been looking for sites for barn owls. And it was funny, I was listening to Richard earlier talking about the wonderful sounds of you know, meadows and skylarks. And I've been doing a lot of work since the beginning of May at night time. And it's just, it's a different world when you're out at night time. And tonight is just a beautiful, calm, still night. And I am hoping I will hear or locate a barn owl. Because barn owls on the East Coast are very, very rare. There's very few breeding pairs along the East Coast. Compare that to places like down in the Southwest, where there are good numbers. And there's several reasons for that. It's firstly, food. Most of the barn owls along the East Coast are catching rats, and there's a lot of rat poisons put down, so the birds are being poisoned. Also, some of the places that they nest, of course, old sheds and old buildings are all being renovated as, you know, Dublin expands along the East Coast, both north and south. But then there's another interesting thing, is that there's a little animal called a white-tooted shrew. And a white-tooted shrew is an invasive species. And in areas where the white-tooted shrew is, barn owls have turned their attention to catching these shrews. And they are doing very well. Some barn owl pairs in the last few years have actually had two broods, which is not it's quite a rare thing in Ireland for barn owls to have two broods. So I'm sort of looking for a whole range of different birds on these nocturnal shifts, as I call them, barn owls and woodcocks. I've been doing surveys of woodcocks. So when you're out at night, the sounds are totally different. The sound of a roding woodcock, you know, it's a very unusual sort of a call over a woodland. I've had foxes, of course, calling. I've even recorded a pine marten which was making sounds in a tree. I never saw it. And the other night, I had a beautiful hedgehog just walk by me. So it's a different world. And in my own back garden in the last few nights, there's a beautiful young long-eared owl calling. So nighttime has a different feel to it. And I have to admit, I love being out, in darkness. There's nobody around, the silence. And what I'm hoping for tonight is to even at least hear the shriek of a barn owl, because I have had very little luck in locating barn owls in County Wicklow. So I am hoping that the area I am watching tonight, and it's a beautiful evening, this beautiful calm evening, and that allows me to hear the sort of strange snoring noises that young barn owls make, or the screeching calls of a male as he leaves the nest or comes back with prey. And that is what I am hoping for. So it's still early yet, even though it's 11, coming up to 11:30 now. I've found that any barn owl I have managed to hear, and there's been very few, believe me, that it's usually around midnight that they start to come out. So I've another 30 minutes to know if I am at a location where there's going to be a barn owl. And I will wait here for several hours. And unfortunately, time after time over the last couple of weeks, I've gone home disappointed. But you just have to keep trying and keep trying to find a barn owl, because they are scarce in Wicklow and in Dublin and further north up around the Meath, Louth area. So I only wish we had more barn owls. They are really, really special birds.
I only wish we had more time so we could hang around until 12 o'clock on the off chance you'd hear one. See how honest our naturalists and conservationists are. They wouldn't even pretend that they were hearing or seeing a bird, even though they're on radio where nobody can see them. But I'm very impressed, Eric, with your dedication, I have to say. Oh, you're gone. But you love doing it, don't you? Oh, Eric has just dropped out at that moment, but he really does love doing it. You have to love doing it, don't you?
Oh, you do. It takes a certain kind of person. Eric is brilliant at this, and no better man. And I hope he has lots of success tonight. As he said, in Wicklow, where I also live myself, it's very rare that you see or hear a barn owl. This is the time of year.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, I have to say.
Oh, well, they're very thin on the ground. Munster is the real stronghold for them. And I'm glad to say that last year they had their best season on record breeding in that part of Ireland. So it bodes well. But problems with rat poison, problems with traffic, problems with all sorts of mortality problem incidents they have there. Eric mentioned the sound of the long-eared owl there, and altogether a much more common owl. This is the time of year, precisely now, when their chicks are calling. They make a sound like a squeaking rusty gate swinging on its hinges. Lots of people will be hearing that at the moment, might be hearing it right now, not knowing what it is. That's what it is, long-eared owl babies.
All right. Niall, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Richard Collins and to Aine Lana, to John McKenna, to Emma Tiernan, who's on Rockabill, to our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, our researcher, John Bell O'Reilly. On sound tonight, we had Tommy O'Sullivan. Thank you, Tommy. And to everybody right around the country who contributed to the programme. It was an interesting idea to celebrate the solstice and talk to some people who were up at dawn and who were there for the sunrise and then for the sunset, and talk to some people who are out and about working. The day goes on, even though the night has fallen. Okay, we'll talk to you next Sunday at 6 o'clock right here on Radio 1 with Mooney Goes Wild Live. But in the meantime, for a late date, I'm going to hand you over now to Cathal Murray.